Hey, and welcome to the Compass podcast. This is Will Foxley, editorial director at Compass. Today, we're joined by James Preswich from Solo. Solo is focused on blockchain interoperability from Bitcoin to Ethereum to more. James is one of the preeminent authors on mining and a lot of the decentralized apps we see out there in Ethereum today. So I'm really excited for this conversation. We're going to be talking about miner extractable value, MEV as become to known, how it works on Ethereum, what he sees it as like a problem or not a problem in the Ethereum ecosystem, and then, of course, what it means for Bitcoin.
I hope that you enjoyed this episode. If you do, please consider subscribing and leaving a review on your preferred listening platform. It really helps out the show. The Compass podcast is presented commercial free by Compass, the number one Bitcoin mining marketplace. If you want to get started mining Bitcoin, source hard to find ASICs, or find competitively priced hosting space, then check Compass out at compassmining.io. And now, on to the show.
Welcome to the show, James.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Yeah, really excited to have you on. Of course, we communicated a little bit here and there when I was at CoinDesk reporting on all things Ethereum. We had some fun with Liquid. And then, of course, Ethereum calls are just there's some spicy ones in between the boring ones. So just excited to chat with you again about MEV.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's MEV and mining is one of my favorite topics to get into. It's just so interesting and there's so much depth to it. Before we get started, I'd like to give a quick overview of like my career path and how I got here. I got started in crypto way back in 2014 and had a company back then. Around 2017, I got interested in cross-chain interoperability and I started working on Bitcoin developer tooling and Ethereum. And we started a company called Summa that worked solely on Bitcoin, Ethereum interoperability. We wrote Bitcoin parsers in Solidity. We deployed a Bitcoin relay. We contributed to TBTC and some other interoperability projects. And last year, the Summa team joined Celo to work on interoperability and the Celo ecosystem. Celo is a proof of stake EVM chain. So it runs Solidity contracts. And my role there is managing Bitcoin to Celo bridges, Celo to Ethereum bridges, just anything that reaches out from Celo to the broader crypto ecosystem.
Yeah, and that's a great place to start. What is Celo and what does it mean for blockchain, like inter-blockchain communication? Because I think a lot of people are familiar with how Ethereum is just very programmable. Of course, that was like a big catch for it in the early days. It was like you can do some scripting on top of it. But for non-developers such as myself, the fact that Bitcoin and Ethereum can't talk or the fact that they can talk is like kind of mind melding to think about. So can you explain a little bit more in depth, like what your job entails and how, like you've been working on this for years, like making these blockchains talk to each other. So what does that look like? And in the short amount of time you have to explain that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I can spend the next like 6 hours talking about this and I would, if you let me. The main thing about interoperability is that, blockchains, you know, they can't like reach outside. All they can do is update their own internal state. And everyone else can see what that state is and, you know, can crawl the history of the chain and produce the same state. But there's no way for a blockchain to, you know, like connect out to another blockchain or to an API. And so interoperability is how we can set things up to kind of simulate that happening. How can we pass information from Bitcoin to Ethereum or from Bitcoin to Celo? For TBTC, you know, we want to know that there are Bitcoin held in reserve on the Bitcoin blockchain. And we need to write an Ethereum contract that can verify that. When we're talking about interoperability between smart contract chains like Celo and Ethereum and all these others that are, you know, popping up everywhere, we want some way that smart contracts can send messages from one chain to the other. And those messages could be, you know, like value, they could be data, they could be just, hello, how are you? But getting messages from one chain to another is extremely complex and difficult. And that's, you know, most of what I work on is trying to make that easy.
Yeah, it's a growing field of study, especially if you fall into the category of people who believe in the multi-chain future where it's not just Bitcoin or Ethereum. And that might shock some people who are listening to this Compass podcast because we more than not are often a Bitcoin only publication, but I happen to like Ethereum. So I wanted to talk about it today. I want to dive into MEV or MEV, though. It's obviously the talk of the town and has been for at least about a year now since decentralized finance took off on Ethereum. But you've been writing about it for much longer than other people have even been thinking about it. So I want to ask you, how did you get into it? What led you to the considerations about it for Ethereum? And then we'll dive into some topics about Bitcoin specifically and MEV, because I think I'm already seeing there's a difference between the two chains and how each ecosystem approaches the consequences of MEV.
Yeah, there's definitely a huge difference between the chains. The way I got into this was back in 2017, I was doing a lot of deep dives into the Bitcoin Core code base. You can find like some of my articles on time locks and on transaction standardness around the internet from, you know, just doing deep dives into the code base. While doing that, I found out that the Bitcoin Core code base, when you're using it as a wallet, it adds a time lock to every transaction it makes. It says, okay, the latest block I know of is at height 500. I'm going to time lock the transaction I make to the height 501. And I thought that this was a really funny thing to do. Why is the Bitcoin Core code base automatically time locking every transaction that it creates? And so I started doing some research. And you can find on Stack Exchange a nice little answer to this question. I think Sipa wrote it, but I'd have to go back and check. That's Peter Willa. The answer is that in the case where there is an extremely high fee on a transaction, more than the block reward, the miner's incentive is to try to reorg the chain to get that transaction and get those fees. And so the miner will try to drop out a block so that it can create a different competing block where it gets paid the extremely high fee. And that's the profitable thing for the miner to do. So when we talk about MEV, which is miner extractable value, those are the kinds of things that we're looking for. Is what are the actions that a miner will take to try to make money by interfering with the normal operation of the chain? In this case, it's trying to drop a block so that it can get the fees from that block. When it comes to Ethereum, you get much more complex behavior around manipulating exchange rates and manipulating the order in which people call smart contracts. So, you know, my interest in this grew out of reading the Bitcoin Core code base and just, you know, noticing this strange behavior that some core dev had thought of back in 2013 or something and implemented in the wallet. I thought this was super interesting and wrote an article applying, you know, this principle to Ethereum smart contracts. And I wrote this back in 2017, and you can go out and read it today. I still think it's a really good piece. And, you know, that's kind of how I got interested in this, was I saw an example of a defense against it in the wild in Bitcoin and wanted to go out and, you know, figure out where else it showed up.
Yeah, that's a great, great read. And we'll include it in today's show notes. So definitely go give it a read if you're interested. So I want to dig in more specifically to differences between MEV for Ethereum and MEV for Bitcoin. But first, I want to get a sort of answer to, is MEV good for Ethereum or is MEV bad for Ethereum? And how do you personally kind of frame it? Because I've seen it all over the spectrum. People have called it morally bankrupt, like armed robbery on chain, to other people being like, this is just natural. It's an extension of how blockchains work. So where do you fall on that spectrum?
I kind of look at it as this is a side effect of rich state. And it is a side effect of the decisions that the Ethereum community chose very early on, and they should kind of just accept those side effects. If smart contracts are useful, then you're going to have to just accept that MEV is a thing, and that miners can make money by interfering with smart contracts.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. So leading up to that question, going back to your article you wrote, you noted that dApp developers should be aware that they are working in a hostile environment. Just necessarily, whatever they're creating, everything is trying to attack it and extract value from it. That's just part of being a blockchain developer. That's very different from working with Web 2 or any other coding out there. You can go ahead and take that away. But I love that line that you had there.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, you're used to having like other people attack your app on an even footing. is, you know, people might come and try to compromise the keys in your wallet, and they won't have any special privileges to do that. But when you're writing these on-chain systems, the miners have superpowers. MEV is when the miners exercise their exclusive right to produce blocks and order transactions in order to make money. And I think it's really, really interesting compared to like classical, you know, computer security.
No, it's fast. It's been gripping me for at least the last year. And I've only gotten into Bitcoin blockchain stuff during the last bull market. And so this was a very new topic to me and basically has kept me up most of the last year reading about it. So the question, I guess, is like a lot of our audience, of course, is miners, you know, Compass Mining. So how do you kind of bridge the gap, though, between dApp developers who are trying to create these projects that bring value to normal users and then miners who obviously are profit incentivized to, you know, hash, but they're interacting with these dApps. And there's historically been a lot of frustration between the two parties, particularly on Ethereum. So how would you think as a miner, how would you frame what you do for the network? What's beneficial, what's not beneficial, and how should people understand what miners do?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because the Ethereum community way back in the day demonized mining in order to make the move to proof of stake palatable and desirable for the community. And that, you know, like choice has affected the next 5 years of Ethereum's lifespan and how people see miners. So, you know, if I were an Ethereum miner today, I would be trying to make it clear that, you know, miners are not enemies of the chain. Miners rely on and support the chain, and their livelihood depends on, you know, Ethereum's success. The Ethereum community, you know, sees miners as their enemy. And I think that that is a, you know, big mistake that they've made. And it affects their technical decisions and their roadmap. You know, my article is titled "Miners Aren't Your Friends," which I also think is true. You know, miners are not your friends or your enemies. They're your business associates. You know, they're people that you can rely on to keep the chain operational because it is in everybody's best interest.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great headline coming from a former reporter. Very grabby. So wanting to kind of steer away from the Ethereum question, which I'm sure some of the listeners are going to be like, oh, thank God we're talking about Bitcoin now. But Bitcoin and MEV or MEV are important topics to be understood. And you had a great paper in 2019 with Hasu and Brandon Curtis, mm-hmm. which we'll also include in the show notes, talking about how from a Bitcoiner's perspective, you want to minimize the attack surface for MEV as much as possible compared to Ethereum, where in Ethereum or any other like smart contract system, there's a reasonable degree of MEV you can have just because they're supporting on-chain applications. But Bitcoin, you want to minimize MEV. So can you walk us through that paper and how you guys came to those considerations?
Yeah. So I'm, you know, I have to give most of the credit for this to Hasu, who did an amazing job putting that paper together. My contributions in this are talking about how MEV exists in Bitcoin and especially how it relates to the UTXO model. As opposed to Ethereum's accounts and smart contracts, UTXOs have much more defined rules on who can spend them and when. And this naturally decreases the amount of MEV available in the system. And it does a really, really effective job of that. The places that create MEV are, you know, applications where many users can interact with the same state. And that's very common in Ethereum and almost never happens in Bitcoin. When we write a Bitcoin script, we have very concrete rules about who can spend it, under what circumstances, in which time frame, and with which, you know, additional knowledge. And all of those constraints are what make Bitcoin much more resistant to MEV than Ethereum is, or any other, you know, rich state chain. So while MEV on Bitcoin is very small relative to the amount of value that Bitcoin is moving around, it is still significant, and it becomes more significant as the block reward declines. The thesis of our paper essentially is that in order to preserve Bitcoin's economic guarantees of security, we need to ensure that the Money a miner makes through good behavior is greater than the money they can make through poor behavior or, faulty behavior. You know, I think that this should be a relatively uncontroversial idea in the Bitcoin community, is we have to make sure that miners are paid to do their jobs. And if they are paid to break the chain, they're going to, at least some of the time, break the chain. So limiting the amount of MEV available is a great approach to ensuring that the incentives stay aligned.
Yeah, I think I've seen a lot of Bitcoiners, just they've been looking from the outside in to DeFi and all the number go up stuff. It's like that Squidward meme. And they've just been looking at MEV specifically and saying, like, maybe this is a quasi solution to the transaction fee problem that a lot of people have posited against Bitcoin, which from your paper itself is just the wrong way to think of it. And so maybe I just want to like kind of clarify that and keep going deeper down that hole. Why is MEV not the solution for this decreasing block reward and increasing reliance on transaction fees?
So the core thing about MEV is that any miner can take it. And that includes selfish miners and malicious miners. And so we talked about this Bitcoin Core wallet time locking thing earlier in the episode. In certain circumstances, the miner's incentive is not to produce a new block on the chain. It's to go back and try to undo old blocks in order to get the fees. So you need to ensure that the miner is not going to, in expectation, make more money by attempting a reorg than they do by continuing the main chain. And the way we do that is by minimizing MEV. Anytime there is MEV in a block, a miner has some incentive to try to reorg that block to get the MEV for themselves. The thing we are trying to avoid here is that the chain becomes a bunch of reorgs, which all reduce the overall security of the proof of work chain. Anytime a miner is spending hash rate trying to reorg the chain rather than trying to extend the chain, we are losing security.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Just the idea of like short-term consensus being overrun does not help out long-term consensus, which is kind of a lot of the architectural decisions I feel like Bitcoin developers have made, and like Satoshi obviously has made over the years, that you want to incentivize like long-term stability of the chain, whether that be like a smaller block size or keeping transaction fees as like the eventual stability mechanism for the chain.
Yeah. The real like problem, the threat that we're trying to avoid, is that we have a ton of reorgs. When we go through and we optimize block processing, or we optimize network syncing, or we decrease MEV, that is the all of those changes are aimed at creating as few reorgs as possible. Minimize the number of times that we have two competing blocks in the network at the same time. Because anytime you split the hash rate across two competing blocks, two or more competing blocks, you are decreasing the long-term security of the network.
Interesting. So yeah, Ethereum has made some different design decisions from the beginning with like Omer blocks.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a negative in your, because I'm just pulling on that thread there. That's interesting.
I do think that Ethereum's uncle reward system is a anti-feature. For listeners who might not be familiar with this, Ethereum allows miners to include blocks that are not part of the main chain, but could have been. So anytime there is a reorg, you can take the block that is now out of the main chain, reference it by hash in the header of a new block, and both the miner of the uncle and the miner of the new block will receive a small reward for that. The initial goal was to reward people who created blocks that could have been in the main chain so that they would not have an incentive to reorg. What I think it does instead is it mitigates the risk of attempting to reorg. Because you know that if you attempt to create a reorg to, get MEV and you fail, you will still be paid for your failed attempt to reorg the chain. I think that the incentive that they added does the opposite of what it was intended to do. Rather than preventing reorg attempts, it subsidizes them.
There's a nice little feature there. I feel like there's a few different things that we've come across over the years, like the self-destruct feature, which they're now pulling out, and then the Ice Age, which these are just random designs for listeners. These are just some designs from like the early days of Ethereum that have more or less been net negatives for the chain. They still exist and are slowly kind of being pulled out.
I think the Ice Age and the difficulty bomb are a really great example of Ethereum treating miners with hostility. Again, for people who aren't familiar with these, Ethereum has in the code base a difficulty bomb that goes off every something like 12 months. And what happens is when the bomb goes off, the difficulty of each block starts increasing exponentially over a few days. So it ensures that the interblock period grows rapidly. And the goal is to force miners to agree to a hard fork. Because if they do not fork the protocol to push back the bomb activation, mining will become impossible as the difficulty ramps up exponentially until no blocks are produced. So it's kind of like this game of chicken between the protocol devs and the miners, where they're treating the miners as their enemy and trying to get, you know, an in-protocol advantage, a way to force miners to do what they want. You know, the funny thing is that the difficulty bomb has never been used to force miners to do anything, but it has gone off three times in the past. And every time it goes off, the people who end up suffering, you know, hurting, aren't the miners, it's the users of the chain. And the Ethereum devs are, you know, not exactly great at managing this. Every time it's gone off, it has gone off accidentally because they, you know, one time they just forgot to check on it. So like, it's a huge foot gun built into the protocol.
Yeah, I remember not this time around, but I think it was the winter of 2019 is when they forgot it existed for quite some time, and then someone threw in an emergency protocol change because they're like, the block time is going up so fast.
They did an emergency protocol, an emergency hard fork over Christmas.
Yeah, it's like,
and I felt so bad for them, but. Yeah. No, it is. They decided to put that in the protocol.
Yeah. No, it bummer for everyone who had to stay up over the holiday season to put in that superfluous feature. But
yeah,
at the same time, funny footnote.
Currently, the difficulty bomb is scheduled to go off around the end of July this year. And so the upcoming London hard fork will include a delay of the explosion until around December. The goal being that there will be another hard fork around, you know, November to merge ETH1 and ETH2.
Yeah, which is a great place, I guess, to take this conversation. Although I do have a few more questions for Bitcoin and MEV maybe we can do at the end of the show. But ETH2 is obviously coming. And I think whenever I talk to people who are just slightly paying attention to Ethereum, they probably have more exposure to the asset than they do have interest in kind of keeping up with the protocol. They're always asking when proof of stake. And I'm on the flip side. I have more interest in keeping track of the protocol than the asset. And I'm like, how do you not know? It's like, it's coming. It's definitely coming. But on the flip side, I've only been in the space for about 3 years and ETH2 has been promised for quite a while. How do you feel about the merge coming up? Is it rushed? Do you think it's fair to move it so quickly based on how miners kind of revolted against EIP-1559? Is that a justifiable reason to move the deadline forward?
Yeah. I do not think of it as rushed. My opinion here is basically, you know, 2 years back, the Ethereum Foundation handed off control and responsibility of the ETH2 project to new people. And the new people have been quite effective in like shipping things and ensuring that things launch on some schedule. So, you know, the 4 years previous to that was an ineffective, you know, team working on ETH2, primarily researchers, and it was handed off to implementers who have done a good job of keeping things, you know, shipping. So I, you know, would expect that we see proof of stake Ethereum around the end of this year. It might be pushed off to early next year, but I no longer expect 18-month delays on everything.
That's a win.
Yeah, that is a win. It is interesting to see that there is, you know, there are the ETH1 developers and the ETH2 developers, and there's relatively little overlap between them, although there is some coordination. So I think it's going to be a, you know, painful process to get everyone on the same page and get everything like prepped for this merge event. But I think that they should be capable of doing that. while we're, you know, on the subject of ETH2 and proof of stake, I want to, you know, like pull it back to MEV for a second. One of the interesting things about MEV is that it is a supplemental cash flow for miners and for stakers. We call it miner extractable value, but it works just the same for people who are, you know, staking in a proof of stake system. Whoever builds the block gets to choose what's in that block. So one of the really interesting dynamics is that miners spend most of their time trying to reduce CapEx and OpEx because those are huge. And they spend relatively little of their time trying to increase their revenue by getting MEV, although that's been changing in the last year. So stakers have very low CapEx and very, well, high CapEx, but very low OpEx. So stakers, they can't, you know, like decrease their electricity costs. They can't decrease their hardware costs significantly. MEV is going to be one of the main ways that stakers can have a competitive advantage against each other. So we should probably expect to see a lot more extraction of value under a proof of stake system in the long run than we do in proof of work systems.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point that a lot of people are just now seeing. I saw Arjun from Paradigm talking about that the other day. I think he's at Paradigm, probably correct me. But yeah, MEV and ETH2 combined to make like very high returns if you happen to be staking, or at least have the potential to from right now, which it's that brings in like a whole host of other questions having to do with proof of stake, like when is the block assigned beforehand and can people start bidding for access to that block? And then that gets into a whole host of questions with like rollups and all that stuff, which we probably shouldn't get into. But I want to jump over back to Bitcoin since we're talking about MEV again. And layer two is a place that I've seen some people talk about, like MEV could be a thing for Bitcoin. Like if you have money on a Lightning channel and you want to close it out, and then a miner can arbitrarily choose how to close that channel and influence like where the funds are going to a degree and profit from that. And I'm not as familiar with some of the other layer two applications on Bitcoin. I guess they're sparse, but maybe like RSK or something like that. And is there opportunity for extractable value from those applications settling between layer two and layer one?
I think that there definitely is. But, you know, again, Bitcoin has better mitigations available for this sort of thing. MEV is primarily generated when there is a contract that anyone can interact with. So Lightning, you know, usually doesn't have that property. Usually, you know, there are specific people that are supposed to take actions at specific times. When we get into like watchtowers and things like that, you know, there might be an opportunity for miners to insert their own transactions to get a reward. But I'm not, you know, familiar with the current state of the art watchtower designs. So I don't know if this is likely to generate significant MEV. You know, like generally speaking, Bitcoin doesn't have to worry about this to the extent that Ethereum does until the block rewards have declined to the point where MEV and the block reward are of comparable size. And I think that it is, you know, going to take several more years in order to do that, maybe a decade or so.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen some, I mean, I don't know what the average is, but I've seen like some blocks, 25% of the transaction fees equivalent to the Coinbase. So that's like a pretty high value in it of itself. And one thing that your paper touched on and a lot of other papers I've seen is like the concept of the time bandit attack and then interacting with that, the Coinbase maturity as a method to protect against time bandit attacks. So I want to get your take on that. Could you explain those two concepts to listeners and then how those, if they interact and how they do interact, if so?
Yeah, definitely. So the time bandit attack, it was introduced in Phil Dayan's paper about MEV. So it coined the term MEV. We didn't have a like accepted name for it before that. And it coined the term time bandit. A time bandit attack is when you take advantage of outside exchange rate fluctuations over time in order to turn an attack that was previously not profitable into an attack that is now profitable. So for example, if mining if all of a sudden someone produced an ASIC that could hash 100 times faster than the state of the art, a bunch of attacks that were previously not profitable could become profitable. Relatively deep reorgs that were impossible with current ASICs would be possible with these new ASICs. So that's an example of a time bandit, is they might go significantly back in time on the chain to make their attack. And the difference in exchange rate of, you know, electricity to blocks over that time period makes this attack profitable. In Ethereum, this applies also to like coin exchange rates, is if ETH suddenly goes up 10x in price, a bunch of attacks to get ETH are now more profitable than they used to be. Again, this is a place where the UTXO model and the constraints of Bitcoin programming, you know, it's unlikely that anyone's going to develop a 100x improvement in ASICs in the next few years. I'd be very surprised if that happened. So I'm not too worried about time bandits in Bitcoin.
Okay, let's get to know. Definitely like an interesting concept overall. The Coinbase maturity was one thing I saw talked about a few times, but I'm wondering if it has anything to do with limiting the application or the assertion of short-term consensus changes.
Yeah. So the Coinbase maturity, you can't spend a Coinbase reward, including the fees, for about 100 blocks after the Coinbase is created. So miners have this 100 block lockup on their revenue, and they have to wait in order to get it. And this serves a really interesting purpose. Bitcoin has this super cool property that in a reorg, unless there is a double spend, every transaction that has occurred can be replayed on the new reorg and will have the same result. Ethereum, because it has rich state, does not have this property. In a reorg, when transactions are reordered in Ethereum and the miner changes stuff up, all the transactions will do something different. They might error, you might get different outcomes. It's very confusing and very unpleasant to deal with. But in Bitcoin, that can't happen. The only exception to this rule in Bitcoin is a double spend. So in a reorg where a double spend occurs, the person who got double spent and anyone that they paid with those funds loses. You know, their transactions can't be replayed on the new chain where the double spend occurred. The reason that the Coinbase maturity exists is to preserve that property. Because, you know, the reason that a double spend causes harm to third parties is that they were downstream of the double spend, is because a UTXO that existed in the original history no longer exists in the new history. So if a Coinbase were reorged out after having been spent, you know, those coins that were spent no longer exist, and anyone downstream of that Coinbase gets hurt, even though the miner wasn't malicious and there was no double spend. So the maturity on a Coinbase transaction ensures that people are not accidentally harmed in normal short reorgs. Anytime a reorg goes beyond 100 blocks and it gets beyond the Coinbase maturity period, the harm that is done to users accidentally, you know, through nobody's fault, stacks up really quickly. Because everyone downstream of any of those Coinbase transactions will lose funds. So one of the side effects of this is that the Coinbase maturity ensures that miners generally don't profit from short reorgs, and that they generally don't try to create short reorgs to double spend. If you were, you know, a particularly large miner, you could potentially create a 5 or 6 block reorg to double spend your Coinbase rewards. But you won't do that because of the maturity.
So is that like is that 100 block limit almost like an arbitrary number that Satoshi or perhaps a later developer put in, kind of like the 6 block rule that we see today, where it's not really meaningful outside of just kind of a rule of thumb?
So the 100 block limit is a protocol rule, where the 6 block thing is a, you know, rule of thumb. And it is just an arbitrary number, though, that somebody picked and put into the protocol rules.
I always love seeing like those little small changes like that.
Yep.
Or, well, maybe it wasn't changed, but those kind of one-off random decisions. It's like, we need a number. So that sounds good.
And, you know, I think it's really cool that back in the day, you know, over a decade ago, the protocol developers were thinking about, you know, collateral damage in long reorgs. Something that was incredibly unlikely to happen for years, and they designed the protocol to mitigate user harm when it occurs. And you know, this is the same reason I was so intrigued by the time lock in the Bitcoin Core wallet, is because, you know, back in 2013 or 2014 or maybe even earlier, they were thinking about eventual minor attacks on consensus and on users. Even though those attacks had not occurred and, you know, there was no evidence that they would, they designed and built a mitigation to, you know, help prevent harm to users long in advance of when it would be needed.
Yeah, no, I love that. And I love seeing the things that Ethereum is either pushing the envelope on or growing with, or things that they're kind of rediscovering from a decade ago. I think there's like a lot of overlap. And of course, there's always like flame wars on Twitter about who created what first, which are always hilarious. Yeah. So I got two more questions for you if you're game, but I want to talk about mining innovations. So I think they're never headlines. They're never like sexy headlines. Like, and who cares about miner innovations? But I think they matter. Like, to me, they're very interesting. So for example, Zcash had a protocol update, I think close to a calendar a year ago now. And they implemented some sort of zero knowledge scheme on Coinbase rewards. And then we have other updates like Stratum V2, which are going to Bitcoin. And if Ethereum somehow stays on proof of work, maybe it would go there, but probably not. What are some things from your perspective that are must follows for mining innovation?
I think that, you know, Stratum V2 is a huge one. It's very well thought out and put together. And there's been a lot of work over the years for it. I think that the Taproot activation is a huge thing to watch for how miners are thinking about and interacting with the chain right now. So, you know, as we go through this speedy trial, we're getting a lot of new information about who updates when and who is actively following this and how mining pools behave in the wild. In Ethereum land, I think that the merge with V2 is going to be really interesting to watch because it is transitioning off of a large mining ecosystem. And in advance of that, EIP 1559 activating in, you know, July, hopefully, is going to be huge as well. These are two things where we get to see how the Ethereum miners interact with the, you know, protocol developers and the protocol developers roadmap. Outside of Bitcoin and Ethereum, I'm really interested in ultralight clients. So I worked with Zcash a little bit on their Fly client Merkle Mountain Range commitment. And I would love to see a prominent chain implement Fly client or U3XO. But other than that, I don't really connect with the day-to-day of mining. So I assume that people know what's going on there and are really good at their job because the chain keeps working.
Yeah, it's still moving somehow. But no, those are some great things. I think the Light clients is always interesting. And I think that's a great point of discussion, maybe for a different podcast, about the trade-offs and the assumptions that Ethereum has made with different types of nodes and that Bitcoin has made, and then all these other chains out there and how they interact. But so I want to move over to one more question before we hop off here. And that is about Celo and your work specifically on inter-blockchain communication. So we've seen recently like the idea of MEV moving across protocols. Is that something that I'm assuming as a developer you've tapped into and are closely looking at? And I'm wondering, what are the implications for each chain? Like, if you're settling a transaction on Ethereum and trying to move it over to Bitcoin, and like there's an opportunity for some sort of reordering there that helps miners and hurts either users on either side. And how do you like design these bridges so you don't have these instances where people are just being kind of held hostage for funds?
Yeah, there's definitely a few different ways to do that. A lot of the, you know, like TBTC system relies on SPV proofs. So we're actually going out and checking the proof of work of a bunch of Bitcoin block headers. And we're ensuring that it has a high level you know, high amount of difficulty in that it commits to a transaction on Bitcoin. And so what this means is we can check that a Bitcoin transaction occurred, you know, with a, you know, hour time lag. You know, we have to wait for enough headers on top of it that we can build up a lot of confidence in it. You know, essentially the Ethereum chain is waiting for six Bitcoin confirmations. I think that in the cross-chain setting, we have to design these systems so that they are very tolerant to reordering. And this means like waiting a lot for proof of work confirmations, you know, like waiting for six or more Bitcoin headers to be made before we commit on Ethereum. One of the like little protocols that I wrote back in 2019 was a cross-chain auction mechanism. And so the way this worked is you would offer Ethereum for sale and you would submit a partially constructed Bitcoin transaction. So one UTXO input and one UTXO output with signed SIGHASH single anyone can pay. And this partial transaction would have a tiny input and a large output. And so it functioned as an invoice. And this is a really cool thing that I'm super proud of and can only be done in a cross-chain setting, is creating this Bitcoin invoice that says anyone, but only one person can pay me, you know, X Bitcoins. When you want to purchase my Ether, you would grab this little invoice, you would fill it out into a complete Bitcoin transaction that pays me money, and you would broadcast it to the Bitcoin chain. And the trick here is that if 10 different people tried to pay me, because there is an input UTXO that they all share, those 10 transactions are all mutually exclusive. You know, Bitcoin is going to enforce that only one of those transactions confirms. And so you get confidence that I'm not going to be able to just take your money and someone else's money. And the net effect here is that the Bitcoin mempool decides which of, you know, and the Bitcoin miner pulling transactions from the mempool decides which of those offers on my Ether gets filled. So I'm offering Ether for sale. I'm giving you my payment details and you can, you know, make an offer on my Ether and know that if your transaction is accepted by Bitcoin, you will get my Ether. And the Bitcoin miner gets to choose which offer is accepted. And so the correct way to get your offer accepted is to offer the Bitcoin miner a tip. And this creates in Bitcoin miner extractable value. So we leverage MEV to create a really cool marketplace that is also profitable for the miners to run. And so we ran a few dozen of these auctions back in 2019. It was very difficult to get people to onboard them because it is a custom wallet that just does, you know, cross-chain transactions. And, you know, we couldn't get enough people using it to justify continuing to run it. But I'm still really proud of the protocol design because it uses a very little known Bitcoin feature, SIGHASH single anyone can pay. And it leverages Bitcoin's, you know, really cool UTXO system to enforce safety guarantees for everybody involved. And it pays a little bit of MEV, but not enough to like affect the operation of the chain. And so we essentially like used a little bit of MEV to accomplish this cool cross-chain protocol.
I can't believe I didn't know about that. We're going to have to chat about that later because that is very cool.
I have a couple like blog posts about how we did this. It ends up being, you know, very difficult to explain on the spot because it is like taking advantage of low level Bitcoin primitives and trying to, you know, hack these nice Bitcoin features into Ethereum via a cross-chain protocol.
So you can do smart contracts on Bitcoin is what I'm hearing.
kind of is you can use Bitcoin to give your smart contracts the desirable properties that Bitcoin has.
Okay. Yeah. We'll take that. We'll take that for Bitcoin, right? Well, I think that's a wrap for us. Thank you so much, James, for coming on the air and talking with us about MEV and Bitcoin and Ethereum. It's great having you.
Yeah, it's really good to catch up with you, Will.
That's a wrap for us at the Compass Podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, please subscribe and consider leaving us a 5-star review on your preferred listening platform. Thanks again, everyone. The thoughts and opinions expressed by the hosts and guests on the Compass podcast are their own and do not represent the opinions of Compass Mining, Inc. None of this content should be considered financial advice.